of my songs, I have casually mentioned the fact that I like to drink beer. This little song is more to the point. Roll out the barrel and lend me your ears. I like beer. It makes me a jolly good fellow. I like beer. It helps me unwind, and sometimes it makes me feel mellow.
Makes him feel mellow.
Welcome to Beer Sessions Radio. Whiskey's on the Heritage Radio Network. It's May 1st, 2012. It's May Day to some of you, but to us, it's the Homebrewers Garden Show. We've got some excellent homebrewers and who are also hop growers. Ben Granger from Beercraft and Peter Kennedy from SimplyBeer.com. We're going to be interviewing later today the authors of The Homebrewer's Garden, Joe Fisher and Dennis Fisher. I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43 and the Good Beer Seal. I'd like to thank our sponsors, GreatBrewers.com. Use GreatBrewers.com to learn about beer styles and take the Great Beer Test to challenge your beer IQ. Again, GreatBrewers.com brings the American beer community together. We're also supported by the people at the Good Beer Seal, an association of 34 New York City beer bars that serve, promote, and support good beer. Check out Good Beer Seal. And we will be bringing to you July Good Beer Month again in July for the fourth year. So here we are with some guys who grow hops and make a lot of beer, Ben and Peter. I don't think it's a coincidence that you're here and we're talking about the Homebrewer's Garden book. Peter, I know that you at one point had done a review of this book.
Yeah, I reviewed it on Simply Beer a couple weeks back, maybe a couple months back.
And what do you think?
Lots of great information. I mean, stuff for the beginner, stuff for the advanced person, lots of information on growing hops, lots of information on growing unique herbs, not even for beer, but even for, you know, regular kitchen use.
Well, just in the intro alone, it says, homebrewers today can buy most of what they need in homebrew supply stores, and this is a great convenience for concerned. But if you have a little land or even a sunny porch, you can grow enough of your own hops, herbs, and adjuncts to make a real contribution to the flavor, aroma, and uniqueness of your homebrew.
Oh, yeah, you can buy them, but it's not as fun as growing them.
And, Ben, what about your thoughts about this book?
Yeah, I think it's like a really it's a really good tool, a really good reference to kind of inspire the homebrewer to brew new and unique things and use, you know, other bittering herbs as opposed to hops. I mean, up until the 13th century when we really started to cultivate and grow hops as a crop, you know, most beer was brewed with other stuff. So, you know, it's kind of a neat little reference guide to get back to that other stuff.
Well, you know, we've been featuring a lot of books and authors recently on the show because I think there are a lot of great resources out there about beer. We've had Charlie Papazian on, but this is one of the most interesting ones, and it seems the most accessible. It makes me want to go, not necessarily make beer, but grow the ingredients for beer. And it keeps coming up, people talking about local beers, about New York State growing hops and grains. This is an amazing resource. I mean, one thing that we've seen on the market recently are more historical beers. There's from Germany, Dr. Fritz Brehm. He's for a while he had the 1809 style Berliner Weiss, and now he's put out other historical styles. You brought in the 13th century Grut, and this other one, which is a 15th century Gradisky. Do you know about these beers, Ben? I mean, what's in them that makes them different than what we're making in the modern era?
Well, I mean, they're brewed without hops. You know, they're brewed with other bittering spices. The exact spicing in the gruit, I'm not sure of. But, I mean, classic gruit is, you know, horehound and mugwort. And it can be, you know, heather. There can be all sorts of stuff inside of it. And the other beer is a smoked sour wheat beer, which is totally crazy. But Gradisky. But when you think about it, I'm sure at some point all beer was sour. Right, and I'm also sure at some point all beer was smoked, considering that you know, you have to roast the grain to arrest the malting process, and at some point it all was done with wood.
Let's open the Gruditsky. We've had it on draft. We had Sour Beer Weekend at Jimmy's Number 43, and this is really one of their favorite beers. It's only about 4.2%.
Yeah,
it's easy drinking. You can see people in traditional times being refreshed by this.
Yeah, being able to drink a few more than just a few.
You know, in the book, The Homebrewer's Garden, Dennis and Joe Fisher, they have some recipes for, they have a dandelion bitter, his honey basil ale, Wild hops honey ale. That sounds good. A Quino bitter. Whorehound brown. What's Whorehound, Ben?
Whorehound was actually, if I remember correctly, Whorehound is a German word for basically mountain hop or wild hop. Just, you know, a bittering herb. I'm not clear. I've never had the chance to brew with it. But if I was to guess, I'm sure that it's, you know, a wild hop.
And here's another one. There's rhubarb ale. And gingered ale. I think in the book it also mentions that even until 40 or 50 years ago, some British beers included some ginger and licorice too.
Sure, I could see that. I mean, it's not easy to grow hops, that's for sure. And during shortage, I'm sure it would be easy to add just about anything. You
especially
know?
With no transportation back when ago, you just made with whatever you had around.
Absolutely. Whatever was growing in the garden, for sure.
Wow,
safer than water. Make some beer.
That's a good argument. You know, there's days I feel like I'd rather drink beer than water.
Some days.
Many days.
Yeah.
So both of you guys have been inspired and learned from this book, and you both grow hops. What are the challenges of growing hops in New York?
Well, there's a lot of challenges. I mean, New York is an intensely humid place. So during what would be the best part of the growing season, which is kind of like late spring, early summer, you know, and even into late summer, we get these days that it's just 120% humidity and it's intensely hot. Now, when we get rain on those days, because we often do, you know, spider mite is a huge problem, and downy mold. There's all sorts of stuff that you run into because of the high humidity in New York. You know, also finding quality soil to grow in is another thing. It's one thing, you know, hops do fine in buckets, sure. You know, they do fine. They don't do great, they do fine. So you really want to put them in the ground, and finding some, you know, some ground in New York City somewhere that's suitable to, you know, grow something and that you're eventually going to drink is no small feat in itself, you know.
And one thing you have to realize is that as tall as hops get, they go just as far down and spread out.
Yeah.
So, you know, they can get 15, 20, 25, even up to 30 feet tall in a growing season, it's going to go just as deep, just as wide.
Yeah, they put out just as much root. So they need, you know, running room, you know. They're like kids, you know.
So lucky for me, I don't have the same challenges you do. I'm out in Jersey, so I actually get a little bit more of a temperature swing. So I get cooler nights, which helps release some of the humidity in the air. You know, so I get a better range of temperature, even, you know, 15 miles outside of the city. And so, but for me, you know, it's pests, you know, mold. If you get dense foliage with no wind going through, you know, you can get the mold. And it's just a matter of loving your plants.
Let's take it from start to finish. So I'm going to go to a store and buy, what, seeds?
No.
How do I get my hot plant store?
You're gonna want to buy rhizomes, and you're not. I mean, you can now. Now you can go to a store. Now that we have, you know, places like Brooklyn Homebrew in the city where you can buy homebrewing ingredients and hops. Years ago, I mean, I would be, you know, like a hawk watching Northern Brewer and Moore Beer and Midwestern and waiting for these guys to put up their, you know, their little signs that say pre-order your hops, pre-order your rhizomes now. And I would just get on, you know, call them or get on the internet and pre-order, and then you would wait.
Why do they call them rhizomes? Why aren't they like seeds or bulbs or something?
Well, they're a root cutting. They're a root cutting from a pre-existing plant. The thing is that, you know, there's male and female plants when it comes to hops, and you really want, you know, you really want females. You want something that produces flowers but no seeds. So there's no need to ever grow really hops from seed when you can take a cutting from a female, and then that's what you have. That's why you buy rhizome. And also, you know, a lot of the prized hops nowadays are hybrid. You know, they're combinations of 6, 7, 8 different kinds of hops. So you really, the only way to get those is to buy rhizome. The only people that have any need for hop seeds are geneticists. And I mean, and they are using, you know, those seeds to crossbreed and things like that and create, you know, new varieties. The only time I've ever even seen a seeded plant or a male plant is there was one growing wild on a vacant lot on 4th Avenue in Park Slope, Brooklyn. I took pictures of it. I was going to go you know, dig it out of the ground. But then I thought, then all my seeds, all my plants will have seeds, and that will be bad.
You know, the other thing you have to also look at when is the area you live in. You know, certain hop plants do better, grow better. You know, they're less resistant to maybe the temperature swings or the coldness where we are in New Jersey or New York. So you got to look at that as well.
What are some hop varieties that do well in the Northeast?
I've been growing Magnum, Centennial, Cascade, Willamette, Hallertau, and they've all done well for me. But once again, you know, it's a matter of not just planting them and letting them go. There's, you know, I go out and look at them almost every day. You know, make sure there's no insects growing on them, make sure they're not intertwining, make sure, you know, I'm cutting any stray brines that are going up. You know, there's a good amount of maintenance, but, you know, if you like it, it's a lot of fun.
So what would be a good number of hop plants to start with if you're a homebrewer? Maybe two or three?
Yeah, that's I would say start. Two or three. It depends on how much space you have, you know, how confident you are, you know, with your green thumb. You know, they're pretty easy plants to grow, and they, you know, will just take over if you don't be careful with them. But like you said, sometimes you can grow them in pots if you have limited space. In the ground, you probably want several feet of space in between your plants.
Yeah, I mean, I'm packed into a tiny little backyard in Park Slope, and I have a ton of stuff in my garden. So I really don't. I mean, you should do exactly what he's saying. Trim them back and keep them spread out and do all sorts of stuff. But I really, I'm that guy who just kind of lets them go. Let's them fill up and go wild and go crazy and climb up a big sculpture and that kind of thing.
And then at what point are the hops themselves ready?
Well, that takes a lot of time depending on the plant. So it'll start usually in the end of July into August, and it'll start growing these little cones. They almost look like green pine cones. And inside there, if you break them apart, you pick off one and you break it apart, over time you'll start to see a lot of yellow in the middle of it. And once that really becomes pungent and you can smell it with your hands and the leaves start to get a little papery, they're done.
Yeah. Once you get to the point where you can see the lupulin glands really like plump and full on the inside, and, you know, you go out there and just if you're growing anything, you're usually pretty, you know, vested in it. You get a little weird about it sometimes. But, you know, every couple of like weeks after the cones form, I just take one and I smash it up in my hands, and I smell my hands. One day, it goes from smelling like plants to, say, Hawaiian punch, and then you're very close. So it goes to, like, it definitely goes from smelling like just, like, a plant to smelling like whatever kind of character it's going to be, whether it's Hawaiian punch or passion fruit, grass or, you know, spice or green pepper, or whatever it might be, you know, whatever that variety kind of has to offer.
One of the nice advantages of, you know, home growing is that you can kind of pick the flowers over time.
Yeah.
Instead of like a commercial grower, which tends to do a lot all at once, you can kind of pick them all at their peakness instead of having a range of flowers that, you know, some are more pungent or stronger than others. You can kind of continue to pick them for a couple weeks and actually get, you know, a decent amount of yield out of, you know, a single plant because you've really optimized, you know, the amount of cones that you're picking off.
Yeah, you definitely have the luxury of being able to pick those things when they're ripe.
Yeah.
As opposed to just, like, taking them all at once.
And then what do you do with the hops? So you take the hops off.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you incorporate them into your beer?
Well, I get my kids to do it.
But do you process them? Do you dry them?
Yeah,
do you do anything to them, or you just throw them in the beer?
I take my kids out there. I show them which ones are good, and I give them a pair of scissors, and they start cutting them down. And we put them into buckets, and then we have some screens set up in the garage with some fans blowing over them. And, you know, over a couple of days, they dry out, and then I vacuum seal them and throw them in the freezer. And then use them whenever I want. Sometimes I'll make a fresh hop beer, which, if you have a lot of hops, it's a great thing to do, but if you really are only harvesting a pound or less than that, you can really use the whole thing in one batch of beer, which I did last year after I had a little insect problem and really killed my harvest. I took all the hops that I harvested and made one beer with it. It was fun.
Generally, I've only ever cured my hops one year, and Yeah, I just did. I put them out on screens and put them inside of a closet, nice and dark and dry. Dark, dry, not hot. Dark, dry, and that's that. But usually, what I do is I take as many hops as I get off my plants, and immediately give them to a local. Well, I give part of them to a local brewery and have them do me like a couple of casks with fresh hops in the casks for the shop. And then I'll make 10 or, you know, 10 or 20 gallons of fresh hop beer straight away. I'm in Brooklyn. I don't have a lot of places to store anything. So I dump them all into
I love batch. That style. I love in the fall the fresh hop beers. My favorite last year, I always like Sierra Nevada Harvest. My favorite last year was the Founders. I got one keg of Founders, the fresh hop, and it was
yeah, really, buddy,
right,
that was
Founder
good beer.
From Michigan. Yeah. And this beer we just opened, the Gruet, going back to historical styles. What's a Gruet?
I mean, well, Gruet is beer before hops. You know, it's barley or wheat. It's grains, water, it's malt, water, yeast, and spices. This particular one's, you know, I think it's caraway and bay leaf, and there's some, I think there might be anise in this. It's really, really crazy, the flavor on it. It's got bay leaf and ginger and anise and gentian and rosemary and, you know, some like really, really crazy stuff in it. But, you know,
I'll take a tap off.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk with the authors of The Homebrewer's Garden. We'll be back in a moment on Beer Sessions Radio.
The minute you walked in the joint, I could see you were a man of distinction, a real big spender, good looking, so refined. Say, wouldn't you like to know what's going on in my mind? So let me get right to the point. I don't pop my cork for every guy I see. Hey, big spender, spend a little time with me. Wouldn't you like to have fun, fun, fun? How's about a few laughs, laughs? I can show you a good time.
Welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. We're out here at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, enjoying ourselves on a very lovely May 1st day. It's May Day, guys, and guess what we're doing? We're drinking historical beers and talking about growing your own ingredients for beer in your garden or your farm. It's pretty awesome. Hey, we've been drinking some herbal and traditional beers, and Ben, what did you say? You're dying for what kind of beer?
I'm dying for a hoppy beer.
So what did you bring us?
I brought today, as I was leaving the shop, we were getting our union order, and I was walking along, and I saw a box I'd never seen before, and opened it up and yelled, "Yeah, buddy!" Because we got the new bottles of Pallet Wrecker in, which is an insanely hoppy beer by Green Flash. We had a keg of it last week, maybe 2 weeks ago.
This is the first year they actually bottled it.
For the New York market, yes. For bottles for the rest of the country, I can't speak to that, but I think this might be the first bottling of it.
So when we talk about hops and beer, we talk about IBUs. That's how you measure. Is that the lupulin count?
That's bitterness, and that's really perception of bitterness. That's how much alpha acid versus how much residual sugar there is. That's basically just a measurement to give the consumer an idea of how bitter this beer is going to taste.
So if you hear a beer has a number of IBUs, like 80 IBUs is supposed to be bitter, is that from a human judging it and giving it a scale, or is there actually a chemical test?
That's a mathematical formula. Yeah.
We'll call it a rough formula.
Yeah, but still, that's based on a human...
There's numbers involved.
A human taste? Or is there actually like a machine that can judge the IBUs of a beer?
Well, it's how much hops were added to the actual beer, at what point they were added, and versus how much malt, water. It's basically a formula that involves all the ingredients plus the level of alpha acid and plus the amount of acid.
So it's something
that's
that the brewer, when they make the beer, they would say this is the IBU.
Yeah, they would calculate it, or they would use a program to calculate it, or something along those lines.
And that particular formula degrades the higher it gets, the very less accurate it becomes.
Yeah, I mean, I've had beers that said that they were, 220 IBUs.
Well, you got that Mikkeller 10,000, right?
I mean,
getting extreme.
Yeah, it's getting extreme. But, in some points, it just doesn't, just doesn't taste like that. And that can be a bitter drink. It can be a bitter drink, but it's not necessarily a hoppy beer, because, the IBUs can be driven up by simply adding lots of hops early on in the boil. But, that aroma, that tea-like flavor, sometimes passion fruit and pineapple, all those huge tropical fruit flavors there, they come later in the boil. And those aromas come later in the boil too. And that's your oils, that's the good stuff.
Or awesome. Even after, with the dry hopping.
Yep.
Well, let's go back. Let's see. Are Joe and Dennis on the line?
We're here.
Oh, hey, is both of you, Joe and Dennis Fisher?
Yeah.
Hey, we just want to say we're big fans of your book. We have Peter Kennedy from simplybeer.com who's reviewed your book, and Ben Granger from Beercraft in Brooklyn who uses your book all the time because he grows things and makes beer. So thank you so much for writing this book. Your book has been called The Marriage Between Two Great Hobbies. What made you want to write a book about gardening and homebrewing? Tough question.
Well, these are two interests of ours. We were... interested in brewing and interested in gardening, and it just sort of, it was an obvious place where those two things came together.
Is this Joe or Dennis?
That's Dennis.
This is Joe.
Joe. And where do you guys live?
We live in Winterport, Maine.
Just outside of Bangor.
I'm from Bangor.
And we actually have a farm. I mean, at the time we wrote the book, we did not have a farm. But since we've moved up here, we've learned a lot more about the subject.
And what's the climate like up there? I mean, it's Maine. I think about beach and I think about winter. How does that affect the things that you grow in your garden and what's your growing season?
Well, I'm glad to hear that you guys are having a really nice May 1st down there because it's pouring here. It's tends to be a little cooler than where you are, and that can affect hop growing. And barley drying and things like that. We can get a pretty wet summer without too much trouble.
You guys have a farm right now, yeah?
Yeah.
Are you growing any brewing botanicals on the farm?
We grow hops. We've always grown a fair number. We've always had at least a few hills around. We're planning to grow some barley this year. And then there's just a variety of herbs that we always grow that we can throw in the beer at any time. There's a ginger, for instance, and
dandelions.
Dandelions. That's a good one.
Let me ask you about this. One thing I loved about your book was the reference to all these historical beers that are made with herbs. I think it's one of the most fascinating things I've read in a long time. We've been tasting some different historical beers like Gruet and Gradisky. You say in your book, and I'm going to read it just because it's so great, it said, "Today hops are the primary brewing herbs, but this was not always true. Throughout history, hop cones were just one of many different kinds of herbs used to flavor and preserve beers." That's very profound. What made you guys go in that direction? I mean... before people were just using extracts and just learning how to homebrew, but you guys were in a totally different direction. You must feel like vindicated now, like you're visionaries or something.
That's kind of where the research led us. It's like there are all these interesting medicinal beers and kind of traditional beers like you were talking about Gruet a little while ago and Runswick Mumm, which is very, very similar. And the thing that they brewed before hops really were widespread in Europe, it's just kind of where the research kind of led us, we've done many batches of most of the recipes. You don't necessarily brew everything every year, like if we had a really good pear year, for instance, we brew some Perry, which is like cider, except it's made out of pears. but yeah, it's very interesting to see things like the revival of heather ale, for instance.
Yeah, have you guys had from Scotland? Have you had the Williams Brothers beers? They use the heather,
sure,
and the beers like Fruk.
Yeah. The Frelk and the heather ale, but and all that.
Dennis and Joe, have you guys ever tried those from Scotland?
Yeah.
Let's take us a different direction. Okay, so the most interesting thing, the recipe in your book is the dandelion bitter or the dandelion stout. How about you want to like talk us through how you discovered that recipe and how you would work with dandelion in making a beer? Because that's like fascinating.
Well, let's see. I suppose I should have looked at the recipe. We were adding the dandelions to the early boil. Essentially, it's like it's a grain and extract recipe, and you know, we extract our grains and then add the malt and add the basically the whole plant. Just like wash the whole plant and make sure it doesn't have any grit and so on in it. About like a pound of plant, you know, the whole thing. It's like stems, leaves, and roots, and then boil it. It's in the beer for the whole boil, and it provides the most of the bittering for the recipe. It's definitely a different kind of bitterness than what you get with hops. There's a little bit of flavoring hops in it and aroma hops, but the entire bitterness is coming from that dandelion addition.
So you're adding the dandelions at the start of the boil, and then you guys are just like dosing it with kind of 15 minutes and flame out hops, that kind of thing.
Wow, that's pretty much what we're doing.
How long did it take you to come up with that recipe? How many times did you have to make it before you dialed in 1 pound of hops per how many gallons of beer is it?
It's 5 gallon batch. And I mean, it was a long time ago. You wouldn't necessarily.
I think we nailed it in one.
I think we did, actually. I mean, it was like you wouldn't want more dandelion bitterness than 1 pound for 5 gallons.
Sure.
Just because of the nature of the bitterness. You know, that's another thing about some of these old. Not so much the dandelions, but some of these old bittering herbs, they could give you some seriously unpleasant, flavors if you added too much of them.
Sure. We brewed my buddy Joe actually brewed a wormwood beer last year. We did a... We did a... what did he do? Because we had done a goza. Earlier, we'd done like a salt coriander beer, and Joe decided that it was a good idea to do a goza with wormwood in it. And he added and we talked about it for quite a while because I thought it was a great idea. And he added the finest amount, and it was just insanely bitter. Very intense bittering from the wormwood.
Let's go to a different thing. Also, one of your recipes, you've got sati, you've got the sorghum ale. It says sorghum beer is the favorite drink of the indigenous population of South Africa. I know that sorghum is being used when people want to make a beer that doesn't have for celiac disease.
Gluten-free.
The gluten-free beer. Sure. How did you come across this sorghum recipe? And do you grow sorghum?
We haven't. I mean, it's not really a crop that'll grow that well where we are. It's more of a warm weather kind of a grain.
Right.
I mean, we talk about growing it.
Yeah.
And of course, you can get sorghum syrup. probably.
But if you could grow it, it would be
yeast in.
So do you like sorghum beer? Have you had it? I mean,
sorghum beer?
Yeah, have you had sorghum beer?
I don't think I've had sorghum beer.
No?
Other than what we've brewed.
I'm just going through. See, I have the copy of your book in front of me. I don't know if you guys.
Jimmy just a second ago mentioned sati, and you guys are actually in the right part of the world to be making sati with the spruce.
We've made
with
sati.
The spruce bombs and the up the in Maine. You guys have made it.
Yeah, we've made sati.
And how did it come out?
I don't know. It was kind of feedy.
Yeah, it gets funky,
yeah,
right?
We were making a lot of beers that are similar to that at the time, and they were all coming out a little bit primitive.
Yeah, yeah. They definitely had this kind of house flavor of feet.
Here's another one.
house flavor of feet.
Yeah. and a lot of it was coming from the kind of, I mean, you know, as a homebrewer, what you can and can't get away with, as far as, you know, what's going to put some wild yeast or some bacteria in your beer. And in those styles of brewing, the brewers didn't care.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of what was fermenting their brew was, you know, the stuff that we don't want in there.
Right.
You know,
going way back,
some of these beers almost tasted infected anyway. So even if you did them right, they're
definitely. The flavor of something like sati doesn't necessarily say beer.
No,
it doesn't taste like it doesn't. Taste malty and hoppy. It tastes sour.
And
a lot of that is the it's the rye, for instance, will make a beer taste like that. But also the wild yeasts will make beer taste like that.
Sure.
I know you have.
That there's an uncontrolled element, but of course that's what that whole style is about.
Now you have
a lot of
recipes. Here's in Peter. This book, and one of the things that I really loved about your book was a whole section you had on insects.
Yep.
The insects that will eat hops and so forth. And
yep.
after a battle with a whitefly last year, this was a great read for me. And my kids happened to get it for me for Christmas. And, you know, I literally read through the book in probably 2 days, entire thing.
Yep.
And I found it just had so much information, was so easy to get through, put it in terms that I could understand, which, maybe difficult for a lot of writers.
Well, we're fairly simple-minded ourselves.
And Joe and Dennis, I'm just saying Joe and Dennis because, we're not in the studio, you're on the air, so I still don't know who's Joe and who's Dennis. Say Joe, say your name, Joe.
If anything sounds smart, it's Dennis.
And then Joe.
And then, actually, it's kind of the reverse of that.
So there's the question is, did you guys start writing this book and start your learning at the same time? Or had you already been growing your own ingredients and making beer for a long time before this? Because we're going back. It says 1998 you published the book.
What's that?
It said in 1998 you first published the book?
Yeah, right. Yeah,
right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We'd been growing hops since about 91 at that point. So, we had some experience behind us in growing it. And, we just
it really only started brewing in the early 90s,
right?
We had some brewing experience under our belts before we started growing our own ingredients.
You got some great information in there. I picked up a lot of the tips that for off-season kind of care for my plants, which are going on their third and fourth year. Basically the simplest tip that I picked out of your book, and it seems to be working really well, was just to add the manure on top of the plants at the end of the year. This year they've along with the very nice weather, mine are up 12 feet tall already, so they're doing good.
Joe, and do you guys have a website that we can tell our listeners about? Or is it just buy the book? I know this. It's Story Publishing. Yeah. Go to www.storey.com. Can you guys stay on for a little while with us? We're going to take a short break.
Yeah, sure.
Okay,
yeah,
we'll take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio.
All right.
How you feel, brother?
Feeling good.
You feel good?
Feeling good.
Okay, so so much bone, brother. How you feel, man?
I feel all right.
I call your name. I don't want no people to know you're in here. How you feel, fella? Right. Hey, yeah. Sure getting down. Look at him. Ha. We're gonna have a bunk.
Okay, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Here we are in Brooklyn, Bushwick at Roberta's. All right, we've got Peter Kennedy from SimplyBeer.com, Ben Granger, my buddy from BeerCraft,
the
good
brewer
Silbar, Jimmy Carboni, and our guests Joe and Dennis Fisher, authors of the Homebrewers Guard. So we were talking over the break, real old traditional fermenting. I'd heard the story about, in the old days, or maybe even today in the country. Imagine a hollow log that some. You know, bees hives has dropped into, and there's rainwater, and it kind of ferments naturally. And then, what were you talking about, Ben?
I mean, the old
sati recipe.
Oh yeah, I can't remember if it was a chef I worked for, Johan, who's a Finnish guy.
Or, and then the beer actually drinks the fermented honey water.
The drunk bears story.
That's what.
That's
it is.
Drunk bears. I can't remember if this was this story was Johan, this chef I worked for at town years ago, or if it's my father-in-law told me this story. But apparently, sati.
Is your father-in-law the drunk bear?
you're gonna get me in trouble, Jimmy. So apparently, that sati was this like hunt camp beer that fellows would roll into hunt camp, and they would mix sugar and water and boil it with spruce balms, and then go get baker's yeast and crumble the baker's yeast up into it. And then at the duration of beer of, you know, hunt camp, they would drink this mixture, which I could also, like you were talking about before, would probably taste fairly feedy. Well, it would probably taste a little weird. I'm just saying.
And then you had one more story, Ben.
Oh, no. I mean, Jimmy was talking about the drunk bears, and when I was a kid. I mean, a teenager, me and Timmy Sherwood would...
upstate New York.
Oh, yeah. Well, way upstate, on the real upstate, on the Gila Lake, Ontario, on the border of Canada. But me and Timmy Sherwood would sit at his house and drink this cider that we made in his closet. And we'd go out to the apple orchards and sit, and you'd see the deer eating the drop apples. And the drop apples are all fermented, so you'd see these deers getting tore up on drop apples. And you hadn't seen nothing until you're a 15-year-old getting drunk on cider and watching deer stumble through fields.
Now, did they really stumble?
No, well, I mean, it might have been me stumbling. I don't know.
So because of all this, you know, since nature's wants is we're drawn to fermented beverages, thank God for guys like Joe and Dennis and teaching us about growing a better. So I'd say the things that you can grow, Ben's been calling them, what, beer botanicals?
Yeah, brewing botanicals.
Brewing botanicals.
I mean, that's what I have a handful of them in my garden. So when, you know, people are over, that's the beer garden, the brewing botanicals.
I mean, we talk about the character of a beer, Joe and Dennis and Peter, and I think that I can imagine, you know, you see what hops does, and I'm a big fan of the fresh hop beers. I can see having some hops and, you know, peppering in, using that term, peppering, you know, whether it's some chili or rosemary or thyme. I see people doing that. I'd love to see some commercial brewers really get a little more ambitious. Have you guys interacted? Do you guys work with any commercial breweries at all, Joe and Dennis? Or is anybody asking you guys?
Herbs in them? Well, there was that Beer Perfetto that Pike Place Market, not Pike Place Market, Pike Place Brewery had. I'm not sure if they still do it. But, the main flavoring was oregano. And then there was, what was that other one? Big Time Brewery had some kind of a herbal beer.
Elysian's got a whole bunch of stuff in the market right now. They got a Yerba Mate beer out right now. It's got a little Yerba Mate in it. And we just cracked open another one of their... it's called... Well, the beers are based on the apocalypse, so one of them's called Rapture, and that one's got Heather in it, and the one with yerba mate in it is called Niburu. But what we're definitely, I mean, from a, you know, because my business is a bottle shop, so we see a lot of this stuff come through. We've seen a lot of interesting beers come through. I mean, the brewery out in California did a rice beer with Thai basil in it. You know, there's been piles of, like, you know, and Dogfish Head once a year usually does something with some really weird stuff in it.
And Peter, you brought some homebrews too. Getting back to homebrewing.
Yep, I brought, we just cracked open, which is the chocolate peanut butter porter. And this has a nice story behind it. So every year I brew a beer for my kids' birthdays. And so for my daughter's third birthday, her favorite things at the time were chocolate and peanut butter. And so this is where that beer came from. It's a giant beer. It's 12% alcohol.
Whoa.
But it has, Valencia peanuts in it, and a lot of Keiko nibs as well. It's been a pretty popular beer. A lot of people looking on my website, looking for the recipe, cloning it. You know, people all over the country are asking me for it and wanting it.
And Peter, you've been a home brewer for how many years?
16 years.
And then you've been in some competitions. I know you're a noted home brewer. I know you're from New York City Homebrewers Guild.
Yep.
Have you won any competitions?
I don't enter a lot of competitions. A couple years ago, I entered the New Jersey State Fair, and I won that with a Sriracha Patters beer. Which was really nice, about 4% alcohol, Belgian style beer with Sriracha Ace hops, very light, refreshing, kind of lemony. But besides that, you know, I enter the NHC, you know, my beer's never gone anywhere.
NHC?
The National Homebrewing Competition. Usually about 5,000-6,000 people enter that.
And that's coming up soon. Is that San Diego this year?
That's in Seattle this
year. Seattle this year.
Yeah. Last year was San Diego. This year is Seattle. The first rounds were completed a couple weeks ago. My beers didn't fare very well. The peanut butter porter fared the best, but, you know,
it's a weird beer. I'll tell you that.
It's a very strange beer.
It's good, but it's pretty weird.
I like it,
but it's weird.
It's pretty awesome. How did your daughter like it? I mean, it was for her third birthday. I'm just kidding, bro. No, this is delicious. I mean, it really does.
And Ben, really you know, you're the owner of Beer Craft, and we all know and love you. You're a good brew CEO place, but you're also a homebrewer, too.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And how many years have you been homebrewing?
Let's see. I think only 7, going on 8. I learned how to homebrew from my father-in-law, and I've been at it ever since. You know, and I don't think I've ever made the same beer twice, and I mostly make beer for consumption.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, and Joe and Dennis, the homebrewer's garden, I'll keep saying your book because I love it. I'm most drawn to this dandelion recipe, the dandelion bitter and a dandelion stout, and I'm going to read it. I've got the book in front of me. Do you guys carry copies of your book around?
Do we carry them around?
You don't. Yeah, I know you don't, because here's Dandelion Stout. It says Dandelion Stout sold here at 2D a bottle. It's from a sign over a shop in Midlands, England, circa 1910. When we think about these traditional styles of beer, you know, you think, okay, the ones from Dr. Fritz Bream, it's 13th century Gruet, 15th century Gruditsky. But you guys are saying that even in the early 1900s, people were still making these traditional beer styles.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, they definitely still had people making, you know, Horehound beer and Dandelion Stout and stuff like that, you know, well into the 20th century in doing their own homebrewing versions of them.
And what changed? I mean, you said even in one of your, you mentioned that even 40 years ago, some English breweries were using ginger and licorice. What changed? Why did it become all hops?
It was there was a kind of a battle.
there was pretty much a revolution, and actually they wound up tightening up a lot of the brewing laws in Britain, because mean, back in the heyday of you know, Mumm and Gruit and things, you couldn't necessarily trust that the beer that you were drinking wasn't going to put you under the table, you know, permanently, or, you know, what was in that beer. They put a lot of stuff in the beers that you would, you know, knock the average customer down, and then they could, like, steal their money. but, yeah, when hops came over, they were not, you know, universally embraced immediately. There was kind of a culture war that, and the favorers of hops kind of won out, or at least
prevailed over everybody else. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I mean, basically, you didn't have a Reinheitsgebot, but it was essentially the same thing.
Well,
you know, you just had the four big ingredients in beer.
Well, yeah, yeah. I mean, it was the market that ultimately determined it. You know, the market drank enough of this stuff and said, hey, you know what, we like hops, and we would like more hops in our beer and a lot less other stuff.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So hops is the winner, but now that hops won, people can go back and check out some of these other styles of beer.
Yeah, and it's kind of fun.
Which is kind of fun.
Yeah,
or you can even mix. You can do hops with some herbs, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know, we have a recipe written at the shop, you know, homebrew recipe, that's a saison that's bittered entirely with wormswood, and then the only hops that are added are actually at flame out.
At your shop, do you sell any homebrew supplies?
No. We go to Brooklyn Homebrew.
But you recommend recipes for homebrewers?
We just talk about beer. That's what we do. We talk about beer, making it, drinking it.
You know, I was in Beercraft in Brooklyn. Check it out if you don't know Beercraft in Brooklyn. What is it, beercraft.com?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And at Beercraft and at Simply Beer and at Beer_sessions, but yeah, you go to Beercraft on a Saturday. A few weeks ago, I was there. I saw Ben. He was in the backyard. They had a cask fest.
Yeah,
a lot of local beers. How many different breweries were represented at the cask fest?
Eight. We with our cask fest, we do a cask festival oyster shuck twice a year, once in the spring and once in the fall. So we get eight casks from all our local breweries, and I sit on a, you know, on a crate and shuck oysters.
And he
all
did.
Day
he
long.
Shucked 1,500. And then in the regular store, that's just in the backyard, the regular store, there's a growler counter where there's a line of people getting their growlers filled. And there's like a sandwich shop. And then it's a great place. If you really want to check out beer in New York and Brooklyn, you got to go to Beercraft. And Joe and Dennis, thanks so much for coming on. We're going to give a shout out to some of the Good Beer Steel Bar events in New York. May 5th is where the Wild Beer. Where the Wild Beer are at the Gutter, which is a cool spot in Brooklyn. Wherethewildbeers.com. Tim Stendel, we know him well. He's an enthusiast. Yeah. He works with Bitter and Esters, which is a great place in Brooklyn. You can go to Bitter and Esters and make a beer with their equipment, and they even clean up after you. This
nice.
Is an event that he does. Tim's a cool guy. He does a clone beer project. We did an event Friday night at Jimmy's number 43. He made a clone beer of a Nognio beer. And then May 14th through 20th, it's American Craft Beer Week. So this is like the Brewers Association. This is like the world of craft beer in America. Go to craftbeer.com and check it out. American Craft Beer Week's coming. And over at Sunswick in Queens, which is one of our favorite bars in New York, Sunswick 3535, Empire Brewing Night, May 16th. And I'd like to thank our sponsors at greatbrewers.com who have helped to bring this podcast to you tonight. Beer Sessions Radio is supported by the Good Beer Seal, goodbeerseal.com. Thanks to Joe and Dennis from the Homebrewers Garden, Peter and Ben,
thanks,
for joining me here. Thanks, guys. Say that again. You guys are awesome.
All right. Thanks,
Jimmy. Thanks,
Jimmy. All right. And here for the Heritage Radio Network, I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks to our producers, Jack Inslee and Brie O'Connor, and guest coordinator Brett Thompson, who's in the house tonight. And we'll see you soon on Beer Sessions Radio every Tuesday at 5. Have a good night, guys. Woo!
Some of my songs I have casually mentioned the fact that I like to drink beer.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
Whiskey's too rough, champagne costs too much, vodka puts my mouth in gear. this little refrain.